Right now on the world stage, as you know, we're witnessing a very ugly expression of the lust for and the misuse of power from Russia's president, Vladimir Putin. History is littered with the names of individuals who took the opportunity to dominate others by force against their will, powerful leaders who viewed the callous infliction of pain and misery on others as an inconsequential byproduct of getting what they must have. Stalin, Hitler, Mussolini, Pol Pot, Mugabe, Hussein, Franco, Gaddafi, Khrushchev, Duvalier, Pinochet, Khomeini, Milosevic, etc., etc., etc. And as much as people may fear these dictators, we should also realize that every single one of them, every abuser of power, is a weak person, deficient in the essential human qualities of compassion and care for others, and to one degree or another, sociopathic. But it's not just world leaders who exhibit these traits, these perverse traits of self-centered obsession. Within many institutions, including the church itself, we have witnessed instances of pedophile priests thieving and robbing televangelists who prey especially on the elderly, the lonely, and the sick. Corrupt popes, scandalous megachurch pastors, and overzealous doctrinal Nazis have created havoc among the trusting and believing subjects who give their lives to serve a living deity that they are told is a loving God. At this time of year, we reflect on the death and resurrection of Jesus, and we read in the Gospels that that death was a sacrifice for our benefit, for the purpose of qualifying a new people for a new kingdom, the rulership of God in our hearts and minds. And Jesus was, in a sense, a ruler in waiting, but not one who sought power over others. In fact, we know that he gave up certain rights and privileges and powers and denied himself on our behalf. The Apostle Paul, writing about 20 or 30 years after the death of Jesus, makes a startling claim when he writes to the believers in Philippi, in Philippians 2, verses 5 to 8, "In your relationship with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus." What mindset is that? He says, "Who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage." He had immense power, but didn't use it in a way that a human person with power might use their power. Rather, instead of that, he made himself nothing by taking on the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross, the most humbling, the most demeaning kind of death possible. Now, this theology of Jesus, not just being the Son of God, like David was a son of God, as a title for someone very special to God, but as a literal offspring of God, who is equal to God, this is very, very new in the mid-first century. And the author of John's Gospel, many years later, will significantly develop this new belief in considerable detail. But for now, Paul asserts that Jesus, with all power, had always existed in an all-powerful divine state. But in order to fulfill the needs of a sacrifice for human life, he was reformed in human likeness, divested of most of the power he had. So for Paul, Jesus was never not God. And he was never actually human in the same sense that we are human. His identity was specifically, says Paul, an appearance as a man, or a likeness, he says, of a human. And it's impossible to define exactly what that distinction is. But regardless of the developing theology, this would have been the ultimate, the unsurpassable expression of letting go of power, voluntarily, willingly, not because of weakness, but in order to demonstrate power. And that makes no sense to us on a human level. You gain power in certain ways, but one of those ways is not by giving up the power you have. And so today I want us to consider the power of giving away the power we have in order to affect real, lasting, deep change in our own life and in the lives of others. When I was researching this topic, not surprisingly, it was very difficult to find any information. In fact, I found none on the advantages of giving away your power willingly, intentionally. Almost every article I read was about the disadvantage of losing power, and specifically how to get it back if you've lost it. So we should understand, first of all, that this idea of giving away even the smallest amount of our power is not a popular concept in culture. But what exactly are we talking about when we say that we need to lose our power? Power in the conventional sense is the ability to have and to do what you want to do by controlling the people and circumstances around us. To lose that power would be to intentionally deny ourselves, to allow other people to have freedoms and benefits to do things that we may not approve of or agree with. So it sounds like if we fail, or if we lack in some way, we give something away, we will have less, even if we're doing it for a greater good. For example, when you make a donation to a charity or give to someone in need, you now have less money. Simple math. And wealth, for many, is the primary path for gaining power. In the Gospels, the religious elites held onto their purity positions, I'll call them, and their status by not touching a wounded or bleeding man. But the Good Samaritan gave medical assistance, gave his time and his resources to the injured man, brought him to a place of rest and recovery, and offered to pay not only the cost of healing the man and letting him stay to rest, but any additional expenses out of his own pocket. So in conventional thinking, when this incident was all said and done, when the injured man on the side of the road had recovered and was back to his everyday, normal, routine life, the Samaritan had a smaller bank account and a thinner wallet than he had before he had offered assistance. Thus, many would conclude, compassion is weakness, because it can cause one to give away valuable resources that you can use for your own benefit. Another example, when you see an elderly person being robbed and you step in to defend the man or woman, you lose power because you place your own security and your own safety at risk. So once again, acting on compassion can place you in a position of being exploited or hurt, and nobody wants that. Another example, when you take some valuable time out of your day to sit with someone who is sick, grieving, or distressed, in trouble somehow, you have less time in that day for you, for the things you need, for the ways in which you can enrich your own life. And it runs against conventional wisdom when James writes in James 1:27 that pure and undefiled religion before our God is this: to care for orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. Pure and undefiled religion isn't going to church every week. Pure and undefiled religion isn't living a sinless life. Pure and undefiled religion isn't saying prayers or reading scriptures or being part of committees. It is so practical, so simple. It is to care for those in need, giving what you have, time, talents, treasure, whatever you have, to someone in need is pure religion. In other words, pure religion is to give your power to those that need it more than you. But what were the lessons that Jesus was trying to convey in his own self-sacrifice and humble servanthood? First of all, I think he was saying that religion is worthless when it becomes about power, especially power over followers and the power to amass wealth from those followers. I don't know if you've ever experienced that, heard of that ever happening, read about that in history. But Matthew 23:1-7, it's one of the saddest parts of the Bible, one of the most tragic parts of the experience of Jesus and religion. This wasn't a local city council doing this, or some kind of neighborhood committee, or an educational institution. This was the religion of the Jews. Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The teachers of the law and the Pharisees, they sit in Moses' seat. This is the position of authority instituted by God," he is saying. This goes all the way back to Moses. "So you must be careful to do what they tell you. They have God-ordained authority. But while you may do what they tell you, don't do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. You do what they preach, but don't do what they practice." How utterly tragic, how utterly useless, because they were more concerned about power than about living a righteous life. He said, "They tie up heavy, cumbersome loads and put them on other people's shoulders, making them follow so many laws, it's oppressive, keeping them in a state of fear and guilt so that they come to them for some relief as the holy people of God. But they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them away." Talk about an abuse of power within religion. Everything they do, he says, is to be seen by other people. That's all they're concerned about, how they look to other people, whether people, quote-unquote, respect them enough, whether their status is high enough among their fellow Jews and fellow religious leaders. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels of their garments long. Yes, they were supposed to have certain things in their dress to identify them as priests of God, but they wanted to be super priests. They wanted to be really liked and acknowledged when they passed by people in the streets. They love the places of honor at the banquets, probably the last to attend, and no one was allowed to eat until they walked in, and everyone would have to stand until they were given permission to sit. They love to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and to be called rabbi by others. 100% about themselves. Nothing in their role was about the care and love and feeding and nurturing of others. Verse 11 to 12, Jesus says, "The greatest among you will be your servant." For those who exalt themselves in this desperate clamor for power, they will be humbled at some point. And those who humble themselves in servanthood, oh, they will be the ones exalted. Secondly, I think Jesus was saying that obsession with power actually makes one weak. The obsession with power, the lust for, the clamoring for these positions actually makes one weak, makes one insecure, makes one jealous and fearful, not powerful and strong. Hours before his death, Jesus is brought before the Roman governor by the Jewish leaders. It's clear that Pontius Pilate does not want to order the execution of Jesus, but he's put in a position where he feels he has no choice. Matthew 27, 15 to 20. "Now it was the governor's custom at the festival to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd, and he was hoping that this hatred of Jesus was just among the teachers of the law and the scribes, because he could tell they were fearful of Jesus. They were jealous of him. They wanted the power that he had over people's minds and over the direction they were going. But Pilate could see it. He was hoping that the average person would maybe remember the feeding of the thousands, that maybe they would remember the healings, that maybe they wouldn't be so turned against him and would release Jesus. So when the crowd had gathered, Pilate asked them, 'Which one do you want me to release? Jesus Barabbas or Jesus who is called the Messiah?' For he knew," it says, "Pilate knew that it was out of envy that they had handed Jesus over to him." And to think that the real reason Jesus was executed, never mind about the fact that it was going to happen anyway or that it was a sacrifice for sin or whatever, the real reason that as that person Jesus was executed was because of envy. Insecurity and jealousy of the religious leaders produced the fear which led directly to the execution of Jesus. Is that a strength in anyone with power? Thirdly, real power doesn't need to prove itself. Powerful people love to feel important, and stereotypically they crave attention, adoration, and adulation. Little do they realize that the need to be worshipped is a weakness, not a sign of strength. Giving up a sense of self-importance and giving our time and attention to those specifically who don't necessarily boost our image to others. But Jesus was trying to convey this message by highlighting the weakness and the failings of people who thought they were powerful. In Mark 10, verse 13 to 16, people were bringing little children to Jesus for him to place his hands on them. That was a common thing for a rabbi to do for children. But the disciples rebuked them. "Stop bringing those kids here. This is the Messiah. This is someone too important to waste his time putting his hands on children. Like, keep them out of here. They're an annoyance and a nuisance." And when Jesus saw this, it didn't just say that he didn't mind. He was okay spending time with the children. It says he was indignant. He was furious. So the disciples were looking at Jesus like, this is a powerful person. This is an important person. So he shouldn't be bothered with people who are of this low status. And Jesus was trying to get across to his disciples, I am not, regardless of who you think I am, Messiah, Son of God, in whatever term that is understood by them at this point, he's saying, I'm not too important to be seen with people of low status. In fact, I sometimes would rather be with those people than with the religious leaders and the important people. And I think the fourth and final and the most important thing that Jesus is trying to teach us by his submission to us, by his humility, is that real power is not the ability to make people do what you want. Even in his teachings, it was an offer, it was an invitation, it was never an insistence. Real power is the ability to enrich the community of others by sharing resources, creating opportunities, and giving encouragement. In other words, increasing the value of the human experience for other people. When you think of Jesus as a leader, not just as a son of God, but as a leader of men and women and children, and you look at what he said, he was increasing the value of the human experience of the people around him in his day. And this, to me, in a nutshell, was the objective of Jesus. That's what he was attempting to do, and he was successful at it. He wept over the state of the self-serving Jewish religion of his day. His heart was broken over the misuse of power and the missed opportunity of those in power to help those around them, especially to the widow, the sick, the hurting, and the needy. Jesus brought dignity and hope and a sense of purpose to those who had been so long neglected and despised. Just look at the former lives of those who followed him. Look at the new people that they become because of what he gives to them of himself. Mary Magdalene was said to have been formerly possessed by, it says, seven wicked spirits and infirmities. Matthew was a former tax collector, corrupt and greedy and outcast. Now these people are presented as being fully transformed. They're now secure and stable contributors to their community and society. They're no longer a drain on the people around them as they formerly were. They have become powerful individuals because of what they have received from the power of Jesus. In his willing sacrifice, fully acknowledging the consequences, Jesus is not just accomplishing something on our behalf because he was a type of hero or superhuman. He was setting an example, and he makes it clear that he wasn't just saying, look what I can do, look what I will do for you. He was asking us to join him, to be willing to also consider how we may empower others, even as much as we seek power and advantages and opportunities, rightly so, for ourselves. This really is the central theme of the Easter season, and I'll leave you with this. It's found in 1 John 3:16-17. It's so simple. It's so profound. By this we know what love is. Jesus laid down his life for us. But it doesn't stop there. James's point was not to tell people what they already, his point was not just to tell people what they already knew. His point was more to the point, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. His was not just a sacrifice of himself, it was a life lesson, it was a calling, it was an example. And he makes it in such practical terms. If anyone with earthly possessions sees his brother in need, but withholds his compassion from him, then how on earth can the love of God abide in that person? In other words, Jesus did it. That was an example. If you don't follow the example, then how is he in you? How are you his? How are you part of his movement? What was the benefit and the point of even knowing him? And we talk so much in theological terms about Jesus and God and their roles, and we get so tied up in the theology of things like the Trinity, and yet when you look at Scripture apart from those issues, you see such a practical guide to life. He's saying you can believe all the doctrine and all of the high theology you like, but if you don't actually follow the example of Jesus, then how does the love of God abide in you? What's the point of it all? So let's be imitators of Christ. Recognize the power we all do have. Sometimes we focus on the power that we don't have. I want us to look at the power we do have. The power, for example, of the tongue to build other people up or to tear them down. To have the power to encourage or discourage. The power of caring. The power of giving to those in need, no matter how small the gift is that we're able to give. The power of forgiving another person and the healing of relationships. So use our power to enrich the lives of others, and Scripture promises that we too will be enriched.